England is burning to the ground. It's insurrectionists all over the place. It's Antifa.
President Trump wants to deploy National Guard troops to Portland. We hear from Oregon's governor, Democrat Tina Kotek.
Today is Monday, October 6th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. France's prime minister resigned today, the third prime minister to fall in a year.
What is next for the country's government?
Attempting a fourth time to fix the same problem in the same way when it failed on three previous attempts.
Also, talks begin in Egypt to implement President Trump's plan to end the war in Gaza.
And the pecan punch is obscure in much of the United States.
But this bitter cocktail is having a moment in Nevada.
In today's parlance, I would say it's very spirit-forward.
Back in the day, we would say it packs a punch.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. Illinois' Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker says President Trump is intentionally escalating violence in Chicago amid crackdowns on crime and illegal immigration in the city. Pritzker said he thinks Trump is using federal law enforcement as political props.
Let me be clear. Donald Trump is using our service members as political props and as pawns in his illegal effort to militarize our nation's cities.
Illinois and Chicago are suing to stop Trump from sending National Guard troops to the city. The White House says the troops are addressing what it calls ongoing violent riots and lawlessness. ICE agents have targeted immigrant-heavy and largely Latino areas. Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson says it's up to Democrats to, quote, stop the madness on the sixth day of the government shutdown. He's calling for the passage of a stopgap spending bill that already passed the House but is stalled in the Senate. Democrats want to extend health insurance subsidies set to expire at the end of the year. President Trump and fellow Republicans want to temporarily preserve current spending. The government may be shut down, but the federal courts are still open. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports on the new term of the U.S. Supreme Court, which began today.
The court's docket includes many muscular assertions of presidential power, assertions that likely will have a willing audience at a court dominated by a majority more conservative than at any time since the early 1930s. Bottom line, the court could end up overturning a nearly century-old decision that established independent regulatory agencies with fixed terms and barred the president from firing agency directors, except for misconduct. Also on the docket is a challenge to Trump's massive tariffs, as well as a case that could end what's left of the landmark Voting Rights Act. In addition, Trump's executive order limiting birthright citizenship is also back before the court. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump has announced another tariff, this time on trucks. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben reports U.S. companies will now pay 25% more to import some trucks starting next month.
Trump made the announcement in a social media post saying the tariff would apply to medium and heavy-duty trucks. Those types of trucks are larger than standard passenger pickups and include vehicles like delivery trucks and semis. The White House in April started investigating tariffing these trucks under a law that allows the president to tariff goods for national security purposes. The Trump administration has imposed several of these tariffs on goods including steel and aluminum, cars and car parts, some copper goods, and lumber. These tariffs are separate from the country-specific tariffs Trump has announced for most countries and which the Supreme Court will soon rule on. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News, The White House.
Wall Street is hanging near its records. The S&P 500 added 0.4% today. This is NPR News. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has stopped recommending everyone get a COVID-19 shot, leaving the choice up to patients. The recommendations come from a new panel that was selected by Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Before this year, U.S. health officials recommended annual COVID-19 boosters for all Americans aged 6 months and older. Three scientists were awarded this year's Nobel Prize in Physiology for Medicine in Stockholm, Sweden today. NPR's Rob Stein reports they've made discoveries in how the immune system is kept in check.
The three scientists are two Americans, Mary Brunko and Fred Ramsdell, and one Japanese, Shimon Sekiguchi. The researchers won for explaining something called peripheral immune tolerance. This is a key part of how the immune system protects but does not harm the body. The Nobel Committee says the trio made groundbreaking discoveries that explain the function of cells the committee calls the immune system's security guards, cells called regulatory T cells. Those cells help prevent other immune system cells from attacking healthy tissue. The three scientists will share more than $1.1 million. Rob Stein, NPR News.
The first supermoon of the year is tonight. The moon will appear slightly larger and brighter. This happens when the full moon is closer to Earth in its orbit. But the difference can be tough to discern, especially if people haven't observed the regular moon on the nights leading up to it. There are two more supermoons this year, in November and December. I'm Ryland Barton. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
It is 4:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Support for this program comes from Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. Weather tonight, mostly clear skies, lows in the upper 30s, areas of frost on the eastern Iron Range. Tomorrow, sunny, highs in the mid-50s.
On a Monday, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Last night, a federal judge blocked the Trump administration from deploying hundreds of out-of-state National Guard troops to the city of Portland. This comes after a ruling just the day before, barring the White House from sending Oregon's own National Guard to the city. It was the latest response to a flurry of moves by the Trump administration to send military forces to Democratic-led cities. The president argues that military forces are needed to support his crackdown on illegal immigration. Today, the White House filed an emergency appeal to stay the judge's ruling. Oregon's Democratic Governor Tina Kotek says there is no need for military intervention in her state, and she joins us now. Governor, welcome.
Thank you, Juana. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here, Governor. I'd like to start, if we can, there with that ruling. Legal challenges are working for now, but those may not hold out. What are your plans if they don't?
Well, I am hoping that the rule of law prevails here. This is not just one ruling by a federal judge in Oregon. It's two rulings. One was about the Oregon National Guard, and the other was about the fact that when the first ruling came out, the Trump administration said, well, maybe we'll send the California National Guard or the Texas National Guard. The judge was very clear. The facts on the ground have to validate a president using this authority. And it's just not true in this situation. And as you've mentioned, the Trump administration is going to the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in the Ninth Circuit, and I assume that those hearings will start shortly, and we'll be watching. But again, this is a tremendous authority that the president has. It must match the facts on the ground. And here in Oregon, it does not. And I think this is a wake-up call for every state.
Okay. I just want to jump in for a second. I think we should hear from the president directly what he has had to say about the situation there in Portland. This was when he spoke to reporters on Sunday. Let's listen.
Portland is burning to the ground. It's insurrectionists all over the place. It's Antifa. And yet the politicians, who are petrified, look, the politicians are afraid for their lives. That's the only reason that they say, like, there's nothing happening.
Governor Tina Kotek, your response to that?
Oh, it's just ludicrous. You know, we had thousands of people in the streets of Portland for the Portland Marathon yesterday. The city is beautiful. The city is thriving. The protests are in a one-block radius of the ICE facility. And the president, I don't know what information he's using. I don't know what he's watching. I don't know if he's watching something from 2020. It's 2025. City of Portland is safe. Local law enforcement has the situation under control.
Walk us through briefly, if you can, your specific concerns about increased law enforcement presence or the National Guard potentially being on the street of Portland, as President Trump has said he would like to see.
To put military troops in American cities is a threat to our democracy. If you think about the speech that the president gave to the hundreds of generals that were gathered a week or so ago to talk about training our troops in the cities of America, we're not at war with ourselves here. There is not an insurrection or a rebellion, not only in Portland or Chicago or other places. Look, there are challenges. There's lawful demonstrations. Local law enforcement is handling the situation. And I think this is an overreaction to the situation. And it's just not true. Facts should matter.
Top White House advisor Stephen Miller has described the judge's original restraining order barring the deployment of National Guard troops as a legal insurrection. His words, he went on to say, and I'm quoting here, that this is an organized terrorist attack on the federal government and its officers. He said that local and state officials have refused to aid ICE officers facing relentless terrorist assault and threats to life. Governor, what did you think when you saw that statement from Stephen Miller?
I don't know what reality he is living in. That is not the situation on the ground in Portland. I have a lot of confidence in the Portland police, who have worked very hard to engage and make sure the situation is safe on the ground. What we're seeing is escalation from the federal agents who were there at the facility. They're still able to carry out their work. People can lawfully demonstrate. And it's just the situation does not match what they think it is.
Do you believe that state law enforcement has a responsibility to protect ICE officers who are working to try to carry out their mandate?
I think we have to uphold the rule of law. You know, if there is criminal activity on the ground, people are being held accountable. The facility there is able to operate, and people who have a disagreement with the federal government can be outside that building voicing their concerns. We can do both things. Now, I don't agree with what the Trump administration is doing about ICE enforcement, but they are able to do their job in Oregon, and people are able to lawfully protest. We can do both, and there is not a threat of violence against those officers who are protecting the building. I just have to disagree with what the Trump administration thinks the situation is.
Governor, I'd like to ask you, what have your conversations been like with fellow governors, including Governor J.B. Pritzker in Illinois, California Governor Gavin Newsom, who I'll note joined the lawsuit filed by your state? What kind of conversations have you been having with them?
Well, Governor Pritzker and Governor Newsom and I have been keeping in close contact. Everybody's concerned, right? Let's think about the individuals involved here. The National Guard members in all of our states, Republican or Democratic states, are citizen soldiers who step away from their regular day jobs and away from their families to serve the country when they are called up. They should only be used in situations of real problems. I need our guard members here when there is a disaster or there is something else. This is not a real emergency. Governors are concerned. They are the commanders in chief of their National Guards. There's a clear delineation of authority. There's no insurrection. There's no national threat in our cities. And I think it's really important. This is not just about Oregon or blue states. That's obviously where the president is targeted right now. This is about every state. If you were a Republican governor and there was a different president in the White House, would you want this to be happening to your state? Absolutely not. This is a threat to our democracy, and this is not the authority the president should be wielding.
We have been speaking with Oregon Governor Tina Kotek. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Talks began in Egypt today to implement President Trump's plan to end the war in Gaza. Israeli and Hamas officials are there in Egypt. They'll be joined by U.S. envoys for the indirect talks. The meetings are taking place as Israel commemorates those killed and abducted on October 7th, 2023. So exactly 2 years ago tomorrow. Here to tell us more is NPR's Ruth Sherlock, one of our team of reporters covering all these developments. Hey, Ruth.
Hey.
Hey, so just to lay out the stakes, the death toll in Gaza now stands at more than 67,000 people. That's according to health officials there. The war is now moving into its third year, and President Trump is warning he will back Israel to the hilt if Hamas does not sign his deal. So what do we know about how these talks are going?
Well, you know, Trump is asking all sides to move fast to complete parts of the deal even this week. But the reality is this could take longer than Trump suggests. There's a lot that still needs to be worked out. Both sides have to agree, for example, which Palestinian prisoners Israel will release. And Hamas says the remains of some of the dead hostages are under rubble and they need a significant pause in Israeli bombardment to be able to exhume them. So both sides are also coming to the negotiations, you know, seeking maximal concessions. A source in the region close to the talks who asked NPR not to be identified because they were not authorised to speak to the media, they estimate that there could be a breakthrough in the next 7 to 14 days.
7 to 14 days. Okay. What about, Ruth, people inside Gaza? How are people in Gaza viewing these peace talks?
Well, the truth is, Mary Louise, you know, every day counts here. Every day more people are dying. And many Gazans live in unspeakable conditions with famine in some areas. NPR's Anas Baba met with Mohammed Nassar, a 31-year-old father in Gaza City. The city is now the focus of intense Israeli bombardment and a ground offensive where whole neighborhoods are being turned to rubble. Israel had issued an evacuation order for the school block where he'd been sheltering. He's saying, we didn't know where to go. We took our children and ran through the streets. They eventually spent the night outside by the hospital, hoping that would be safer. But there were no walls between them and the bombardment, which he described as hell beyond imagination. He told Baba it brought him unbelievable joy hearing that Hamas may soon release Israeli hostages, seeing it as a glimmer of hope for peace. And most Gazans are just desperate for an end to the bombardment.
And then bring us some of the reporting from inside Israel, which is marking the second anniversary of the Hamas-led attack. As I mentioned, in 2023, that attack left something like 1,200 people dead, another 250 or so people taken as hostages. What is the mood right now inside Israel?
Yeah, my colleague Emily Fang went to the Nir Oz kibbutz in Israel, which still has 9 hostages in Gaza. She attended a gathering in the cemetery among gravestones from people who died in the October 7th attack, and it was a somber moment of remembrance. Families of the hostages are doing everything they can to keep up the pressure for a deal, even pushing the Norwegian Nobel Committee to award the Peace Prize to President Trump. The Vatican Secretary of State, Cardinal Pietro Parolin, he described Hamas's October 7th attacks as an inhuman massacre of innocent people, but also said Israel's offensive disregards, quote, the fact that it is targeting a largely defenseless population already pushed to the brink.
That's NPR's Ruth Sherlock in Rome. Thank you, Ruth.
Thank you.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. Coming up next is your daily dose of phonology, where John Latimer looks back at his nature notes from this date. We need you to defend KAXE with your donations. Due to funding losses, these are uncertain times for our little station. There are many ways to preserve people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Visit KAXE.org or call Heather at 218-326-1234.
On today's date, October 6th, 1994, the tamaracks are starting to turn solid color. They've been teasing us by getting a little bit yellow, but now they have approached a full, solid yellow color. My 30-year average of the event places it on the 4th. So we are a couple days late this year, but well within the realms of possibility. The earliest I ever had tamaracks go to solid color was on September 23rd in 2014. Keep an eye on the tamaracks. They're going to become quite spectacular. They'll shade from the bright yellow now to smoky gold, as Aldo Leopold called it, and then sort of a ratty orange, and finally, just bare branches.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm, Arm.com. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. The latest French government lasted just 18 hours as France's third prime minister in only a year resigned today. The two premiers before him were brought down in no confidence votes. He didn't even get that far. The chaos has plunged France into a deepening political crisis. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports.
Prime Minister Sébastien Lecornu named the ministers who would have formed his government only last night. The opposition on the right and left threatened to bring it down in a no-confidence vote. But Lecornu resigned this morning before they even got the chance. He told the French it would have been impossible to govern and pass a budget.
No one has a majority in parliament, yet no one wants to cede a thing. We need less ego, more humility, and a spirit of compromise. You have to put the country before your party.
France's fractured parliament is the result of snap legislative elections called a little over a year ago by President Emmanuel Macron in a risky move that saw him lose his center-right reformist majority. The National Assembly is now dominated by the far right and left, which both want a premier from their camp. There were two rounds of strikes and protests against Lecornu since Macron chose him as prime minister 27 days ago. Protesting union member Youssef Hamad says Macron is ignoring the will of the people. They don't want his austerity budgets, he says.
We've come out to remind the French government that the debt problem must not be resolved on the backs of the working class. Let's take the money where it is, from the rich and companies who benefit from tax cuts.
Macron has asked Lecornu to find some way out of the crisis by Wednesday night, but analysts say the president has three options now. He can pick another prime minister, dissolve parliament and call new legislative elections, or step down with a year and a half left in his term. Political scientist Corinne Meloul says Macron would never leave office, but picking another premier seems pointless too.
Attempting a fourth time to do exactly the same thing, to fix the same problem in the same way when it failed on three previous attempts,
is the definition of lunacy, she says. Some say Macron could name a premier from the center-left Socialist Party and try to build a coalition with the center-right. But Meloul says that would mean sacrificing his free market pro-business agenda.
The socialists would demand that the retirement reform be either totally scrapped or changed in a way that would completely erase the intention. And then the, you know, tax the rich thing. These are the two symbolic victories that the socialists would demand. And it would mean, I think for Macron, it would mean complete defeat.
Meloul says picking a prime minister from the far right is out of the question for Macron. The national rally seems to be licking its chops at Macron's latest misfortunes. Leader Marine Le Pen lost to Macron twice in presidential elections, but today her party is the largest in parliament and the most popular in France, with around 33% support.
On est au bout du chemin. Il faut arrêter.
We're at the end of the road, she said. We have to stop the absurdity of naming prime minister after prime minister and go back to the ballot box and let the French people decide. The French stock market dropped on news of the prime minister's resignation, and French borrowing costs have risen to their highest level in over a decade. Meanwhile, the country waits to see what its unpopular and increasingly isolated president will do. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
The pecan punch is a strong, bitter cocktail, obscure in most of the country, but well-known in northern Nevada. It's a culinary contribution from 19th century Basque immigrant sheep herders, and it's having a big year in the Sagebrush State, as Phil Corbett reports.
A late summer storm eats at the mountains above Gardnerville, Nevada. At the JT Basque Bar and Dining Room, cowboy hats, berets, and dollar bills hang from the walls and ceiling.
You just ordered your first pecan punch. You look around, and 9 out of 10 people around you are also drinking a pecan punch.
That's Marie-Louise Leckenberry, whose family is Basque and bought the JT in the 60s. They've been serving pecans ever since. The pecan punch has a lot of poetic resonance with northern Nevada. It's quite brown, often maligned, and is almost always explained as an acquired taste.
I would say in today's parlance, I would say it's very spirit forward. Back in the day, we would say, careful, it packs a punch.
Marie-Louise Leckenberry and her nephew Etienne Leckenberry explain the bitter cocktail is spelled P-I-C-O-N. Unrelated to the pecan nut. It's named for its original main ingredient, a mer pecan, an orange-rind liqueur that is flavored with cinchona bark and gentian root.
Which is not a sweet root. You know, it really adds a body of complexity to the liqueur.
The Basque country in Europe straddles Spain and France, and the original mer pecan is French. It's not clear exactly where the pecan punch cocktail was invented, but the drink became popular in a few places in the American West where Basque immigrants settled.
It is the mixed drink. It is the dash of grenadine, the shot of a mer pecan, the splash of club soda, or not, and the float of brandy with a lemon twist. And that is a cocktail born exclusively within the American West.
By the 1980s, the original maker of a mer pecan had changed the recipe, lowering the alcohol content. Another company in California called Tarani became the primary supplier of a foolproof liqueur for the cocktail. At times, that made the supply feel precarious, like in 2024 when a shortage swept across the state.
One day we just didn't get Tarani.
Chris Barkley is a bartender at Casale's Halfway Club in Reno, Nevada.
Really find anything damn near impossible, and when you try to find a substitute for it, it just wasn't working.
The shortage only lasted a couple of months, but rumors started to spread that Tarani might drop the product entirely. Then, earlier this year, they gave the recipe to a Nevada distillery free of charge, moving production of the main ingredient to Nevada for the first time.
They decided last year that they were going to pass the torch, and they chose us.
Joe Canella owns Farino Distillery in Reno, which got the recipe.
We have now have this like important component of this thing, this very important like Nevada thing, and obviously Nevada Basque thing, and it's my job to keep it going.
Shortly after the first batches were made in Reno, state lawmakers passed a bill, and in June, the pecan punch officially became the state drink of Nevada.
People coming to Nevada for the first time, they look out and they say, there's nothing here. And it doesn't take them very long to feel what that ocean of sagebrush just did to you. And I would say that's very similar with the pecan punch.
At first, she says, the high Nevada desert can be harsh, like the drink. But once you get into it, it's really quite lovely. For NPR News, I am Phil Corbett in Reno.
This is NPR News.
It is 4:29, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered this Monday afternoon here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is National Native News. We receive support from the First National Bank of Coleraine since 1906, serving the needs of the community and working with their friends and neighbors, with branches in Coleraine and Grand Rapids. More information at ColeraineBank.com, member FDIC. On the River is our volunteer-hosted mix of folk, rock, jazz, blues, and world music on KAXE 7 days a week. Trained community members choose the music every weekday at 1 and 7, plus Saturdays at 4 and Sundays at 1. Big thanks to our dedicated volunteers. We receive support from ICTV. Stay tuned, stay connected with ICTV. Learn more at watchictv.org. And don't forget, you can visit our website, kaxe.org, for the latest Up North report, the set list, and area voices.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A resource guide to help small and medium-sized governments in the Great Lakes region adapt to climate change has been published. Chuck Kornbach reports that some tribal communities in the area are already trying to reduce problems caused by higher temperatures and additional flooding.
The guide is from the International Joint Commission, or IJC, which helps implement the Boundary Waters Treaty of 1909 between the U.S. and Canada. Liz Kirkwood of the IJC's Water Quality Board says climate change has brought more severe storms, loss of ice cover, and extreme temperatures to much of North America, including the Great Lakes region.
In 2024, extreme weather disasters cost the eight Great Lakes states more than $13 billion U.S. dollars combined. Some of the costliest disasters happened in the last 5 years.
While debate continues over how to reduce air pollution that contributes to climate change, the IJC has published a guide aimed at helping small and medium-sized governments adapt to the new temperatures and heavier rainfalls. Charlie Rasmussen of the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission says his organization welcomes the sharing of best practices, funding ideas, and other strategies. He says the commission's 11 Ojibwe member tribes in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Minnesota are already taking steps, sometimes in collaboration with local, state, or federal agencies. One project being Ishkade. That's using prescribed or controlled fires on land next to water.
They help maintain and reestablish native species that do the best job at holding the soil and able to resist, you know, some of these severe precipitation events.
Rasmussen says other tribes are putting in larger roadside culverts to reduce highway damage from flooding and to help wildlife move. He says tribes also share TEK, or traditional ecological knowledge.
It encourages building relationships with plants, animals, and water as living beings rather than just a natural resource that you manage.
The International Joint Commission says it recognizes its climate adaptation guide has some gaps, including needing more content from First Nations and island communities. For National Native News, I'm Chuck Kornbach.
Family, friends, and colleagues from across Indian country gathered Friday and Saturday on the Oneida Nation in Wisconsin for funeral services to honor Ernie Stevens Jr., chairman of the Indian Gaming Association. Stevens is being remembered as a longtime advocate for Indian country and for making strides in Indian gaming. During visitation on Friday, streamed online, his son Brandon Stevens said he was an amazing tribal leader who fought for Native voices, sovereignty, and future generations. And above all else, he said he was a family man.
To his family, he was more than a leader. He was a man who loved us without hesitation, who protected us, and who always reminded us that family is everything. No matter what we did in our lives, good, bad, or ugly, he looked straight through us and said, "You are my children, and I love you."
Stevens died suddenly at age 66 on September 26th. U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski says temporary federal funding for 14 tribal broadcasting stations in Alaska from the Bureau of Indian Affairs will help keep the lights on, but says the job is not done. In a recent statement, Murkowski said the funding will help some of the state's most rural radio stations make ends meet for now, but it's one-time funding. $10 million in BIA existing funding will support native-serving stations in the U.S. This follows the rescission by Congress of $1.1 billion for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. October 1st marked the first day public media operated without federal funding. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Drummond Woodsum, a full-service law firm whose nationally recognized tribal nations practice provides services to tribal nations and their enterprises and to companies that do business with tribes across the country. More at dwmlaw.com.
Support by AARP, whose Family Caregiver Resource Guide is available to caregivers by calling 877-333-5885 or at aarp.org/caregiver resources.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at AmazonBusiness.com. From your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting, YPTC.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. CBS's new editor-in-chief says two groups of people have increasing power over the media. The, quote, America-loathing far left and the, quote, history-erasing far right. She says she wants to appeal to the vast majority of Americans in the middle. We are talking about Barry Weiss, the former New York Times opinion editor who left the Times to launch the Free Press and today added one more title to her resume. NPR's David Folkenflik is here with more. Hey.
Hey, Juana.
So, David, start by just telling us, what do we need to know about Barry Weiss?
Well, she was an op-ed editor and writer for the Wall Street Journal, then the New York Times, sort of staked out a contrarian center-right position. And she left the New York Times with a blast in July of 2020 at sort of the height of the social justice movement that was coursing through the streets, but also through many newsrooms. She said her colleagues in an open letter to the Times' publisher, A.G. Sulzberger, were illiberal and, in fact, bullying of her, unwilling to engage in open thought. And she started a Substack that she built into the Free Press with her wife and her sister. The Free Press was a views and news site that basically became a home for people who felt that the mainstream media had lost its way and lost sight of what they thought of as traditional values, but also thought that things had gotten too woke in their phrasing. So they took a lot of critical looks at the way in which the press covered the Israel-Hamas war, and they took, in fact, a critical look at NPR as well.
That's right. Now she is landed at CBS in a prominent job. What does she say is in store for CBS?
Well, so Weiss has announced what she said are these 10 precepts, these fundamental journalistic values that she wants the network to get back to. Two of them seem to me to be very focused on the idea of the reporting to be factually based. She says she wants to hold both major parties to account, that stories shouldn't be predetermined. They should go where the facts take them. You know, David Ellison, who's the CEO and leader of Skydance, the parent company for CBS and Paramount Global, bought the Free Press. I'm told it's for about $150 million in stock and cash.
Do you have a sense of what he wants to accomplish by making her editor-in-chief of CBS and buying her news site, The Free Press?
Well, they've talked about the idea that they want to appeal to the middle, from the center-left to the center-right. They say there's about 70% of the country that isn't being well-served, and that they hope in some ways to return CBS to being truly a broadcaster. The idea is reaching as large an audience as possible, you know, even in an age of these fracturing audiences where, you know, often these narrower slices in the cable world and the streaming world are what's driving audiences.
How should we look at all of these changes going on right now at CBS?
Look, a lot of what they're saying seems to me pretty reasonable in journalism. The idea of holding people accountable, the idea of being factually based in a time of such loud opinion mongering, the idea of saying a contrarian voice like Weiss's might well be welcome at the top levels of an American news organization, taken into account as people set their news agendas. I think you can't look at this, though, without thinking about the context in which this is being done. President Trump has filed lawsuits against many of the nation's top news organizations, CBS among them. In fact, CBS's previous owners paid $16 million to get rid of that individual lawsuit to make sure that its sale to the Ellisons could get through. The Ellisons needed the Trump administration's approval to acquire CBS's parent company. President Trump has just gotten them a stake in the American version of TikTok. Mm-hmm. They're looking to the administration, perhaps, if they make a bid for CNN's parent company. That's the context in which we look at this as well. So are they going to be, you know, change makers? Are they going to be trying to figure out a new way to keep CBS consistent to long-held values? Or are they doing it to please a political figure?
We'll have to
see.
Exactly
right.
NPR's David Folkenflik, thanks.
You bet.
Many of us have a venue we love, a theater or concert space where we really feel at home. But what do you do if that place goes through radical change? Well, that is what has been happening with audiences here in the D.C. region ever since President Trump took over the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts 8 months ago. Trump abruptly fired its leaders, dismissed board members, criticized past programming as too woke. NPR's Elizabeth Blair wanted to find out where the fans are going.
A pride event by the Gay Men's Chorus of Washington moved to a church. A cabaret performance marking the 50th anniversary of the end of the Vietnam War moved to a club across town and sold out. And singer and banjo player Rhiannon Giddens moved her show to a concert venue called The Anthem.
It turned out to be an absolutely gorgeous night, and she had more fans in the room in our venue than she could have had at the Kennedy Center had it gone through before.
Audrey Fix Schaefer is communications director for IMP, which owns or operates a number of venues in the D.C. area, including the Anthem, the 930 Club, and Lincoln Theater.
When the changes at the top of the Kennedy Center first happened, it was kind of a spasm in the community and with artists that were already booked to play.
It also rattled longtime Kennedy Center patrons. With multiple stages, the Kennedy Center has historically been a place for theater, dance, comedy, jazz, hip-hop, and classical music lovers alike. It's home to the National Symphony Orchestra, though the NSO has its own management structure. Longtime patron Mitch Bassman says he and his family have been going to the Kennedy Center for some 30 years.
We have been subscribers to the National Symphony Orchestra classical series for as long as I can remember. And for maybe a dozen years or so have been subscribers to the theater series. And my kids were active at the Kennedy Center when they were growing up. We've always enjoyed going there.
But when Bassman and his wife learned that the Kennedy Center's new leadership would be booking non-equity shows, they decided to end their theater subscription.
I'll be quite honest, I'm not a supporter of the current management of the Kennedy Center. But my wife and I are very firm supporters of the National Symphony Orchestra, and we did renew our season subscription to the NSO Classical Series.
The D.C. area has an abundance of places for live entertainment. Arena Stage is a theater where shows with Broadway ambitions often get their start. After a recent performance of Damn Yankees, I talked to patron Mason Ice. He says he used to like going to the Kennedy Center so much, he moved to be closer to it.
I was excited, before everything happened. So it's been upsetting, but glad that we have other fantastic options in D.C.
I says he recently bought his first subscription to National Theater, D.C.'s main stop for Broadway tours. People are making choices, says theater artist Aaron Posner. He's currently directing a play at Ford's Theater.
Audiences are wondering how to walk the balance these days between what they want to see and what they care about and how they live and honor their own values as well. And so that balance, which has always been complicated, feels more complicated. So I think there's going to be a fair amount of a realignment going on in the theater community as people figure out where they belong.
Other venues in the D.C. region could stand to gain. But Audrey Fix Schaefer of IMP says what's happening at Washington, D.C.'s most prominent performing arts center isn't cause for celebration.
The Kennedy Center, which is a venue that is absolutely beloved internationally, it's a treasure. And I don't enjoy seeing people feel like they either can't play there or don't want to spend their money there. I understand those feelings. But as an institution, I want it to live on way beyond my lifetime and my kids' lifetime and my grandkids' lifetime because of its place in history, and it's gorgeous.
The Kennedy Center did not respond to request for comment, but its new leadership has said in interviews they want people from all walks of life to feel welcome. One of the ways it's trying to attract new audiences is to do more faith-based programming. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You are listening to All Things Considered here on member-supported radio, KAXE-KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is North Star Stories. Support comes from Thrive Up North, sharing the stories of a welcoming community of people who have chosen to make Itasca County their new home, promoting all the area has to offer, including natural amenities and jobs in healthcare, manufacturing, and more, offering an incentive package to help with your move to the area. Learn more at thriveupnorth.com. Happy Dancing Turtle is offering Family Nature Play Days, a chance for children ages 2 to 7 and their families to explore nature at the Hunt Utilities Resilient Living Campus in Pine River. Dates are Friday, October 10th from 10 to 11:30 a.m. and Tuesday, October 14th from 3:30 to 5 p.m. Find more info at happydancingturtle.org. Now it's time for North Star Stories here on KAXE-KBXE.
You are listening to North Star Stories, voices from where we live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
In today's segment, a man pleads guilty to mosque arsons. Then, as we approach the deadline set by the governor, we take a look at the state of broadband in Minnesota. And more than 50,000 students benefit from a unique financial aid program. I'm Gracie J. A 38-year-old man pleaded guilty to arson and damaging religious property after setting fires at two Minnesota mosques. Prosecutors say the man lit a blaze inside an Islamic center in Minneapolis in April 2023, then set fire to a mosque in Bloomington the next day. The man will be sentenced at a later date. The plea comes after a report last week that a Minneapolis mayoral candidate and state senator's campaign office was vandalized with an Islamophobic message and threat painted on a wall. Next, Governor Tim Walz set an ambitious goal for all Minnesotans to have broadband access. While progress has been made throughout the state, as we approach the 2026 deadline, it appears the state will fall short of that goal. Jose Ozoria has the story.
Minnesota has an ambitious goal of establishing high-speed broadband connectivity throughout the state by 2026. While progress has been made, as we approach the end of 2025, it appears the state will fall short of that goal, with large pockets of Minnesota having no internet service, poor internet service, or inconsistent internet service. Bree Mackey, the executive director of the Office of Broadband Development, share some of the most recent data.
Based on numbers in December of 2024, there was still about 143,000 homes and businesses that do not have the 25x3 speeds in their homes or places of business, and about another 189,000 homes and businesses that are lacking the 100x20.
These findings mean approximately 143,000 Minnesota homes and businesses are without basic internet for uploading and downloading content. The 2024 numbers also indicate that thousands of homes and businesses lack access to high-speed internet. Ms. Mackey says that these conditions are widespread based on very specific factors.
There are pockets across the state and in almost every county. Minnesota is a really big state, a huge agricultural state, and the density is less the further out we go. No matter where you are in the state, if you don't have it, you're impacted.
Scott County in the Southwest Metro is an example of a region where service providers encounter various landscape hurdles as they attempt to provide connectivity with not only a metro area, but substantial agricultural land and underdeveloped areas. Perry Mulcrone, legislative and fiber program manager for Scott County, tells us the realities of bringing internet service to all homes and businesses in Scott County.
We don't have a timeline. It just, you know, we try to do what we can, working with the Office of Broadband Development every year, identifying areas that we know where we still have remaining gaps, actively encourage providers to finish and bring up service to these remaining locations.
In Scott County, along with access and connectivity, the affordability of service is important.
Competition helps keep costs in check. We just kind of let the market play out. Any carriers that want to come and provide services in Scott County, we can help them provide middle mile.
The Broadband Equity Access and Development Program, or BEAD, is a federal program established to implement statewide internet connectivity throughout the country. Bree Mackey says changes by the Trump administration has delayed funds from the $652 million allocated for the state.
In June, a policy notice from this new administration came to us. And with that, some of the requirements that were in the previous administration were changed.
Minnesota's Task Force on Broadband considers broadband connectivity as a cornerstone of the state's prosperity. While it appears the state will miss its ambitious deadline, the overall goal remains. For North Star Stories, I'm Jose Osoria.
You are listening to North Star Stories. More than 53,000 Minnesota students received tuition help from the North Star Promise Program, or NSP, in its first year. The Office of Higher Education says NSP exceeded expectations for the 2024-25 school year. The program is for students from families with incomes under $80,000 attending public or tribal colleges. NSP covers tuition and fees after other forms of aid are applied. Officials say North Star Promise is driving higher college enrollment across the state.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Writer Beth Macy grew up in Urbana, Ohio, a place that was rich in diversity and community, even if she grew up in what she describes as a poor, dysfunctional family.
It was a rough growing up, but I had one stable parent, which I really want to point out, a grandmother next door that taught me how to read. It was like my own private head start. And I had really, really good teachers.
Macy knew people on almost every block of every street. Her community helped raise her out of poverty and into a college education.
One mom made me lunch every single day of school. Another friend took me to school every day. Yet another friend brought me home from softball practice, which allowed me to do all the things other college-going kids were going to do.
But she has watched Urbana go from a town with stable factory jobs and good schools in the 1970s and 80s to a place bearing the heavy weight of unemployment, addiction, and plummeting graduation rates. Macy is now an award-winning author and journalist. And for her new memoir, Paper Girl, she returns to her hometown to understand why Urbana has transformed so dramatically and what Urbana can tell us about this country. I asked Macy, when did she first notice the changes in her hometown?
I first noticed it in my family. Division, and we never used to talk about politics, but around when Trump was elected, my brother, Tim, unfriended me on Facebook because of, quote, all the liberal crap you post, and we had been very close. And then kind of the pinnacle moment happened at my mom's deathbed in 2020. It happened to be the Saturday after the election, and I was sitting with the hospice nurse and my evangelical sister, who had previously never spoken of politics, and the nurse's phone blinged, and she goes, they're calling it for Biden. And my sister said, you wait, it's fraudulent. He won't win. And mom is literally laying in her deathbed going, you know, she could die at any moment. And I just thought, oh my goodness, what has happened? I had noticed in my hometown, which was a hotbed of abolitionist activity, an underground railroad haven, but there were now Confederate flags flying. And after mom died, I just thought, what has happened to my family, my hometown, and my country? And so I decided to go back and try to figure out what had caused the changes.
That was a central question. And it wasn't just a shift in political attitudes that you were trying to explain. You write that unprecedented forces were actively turning the community I loved into a poorer, sicker, angrier, and less educated place. And I want to talk about that with respect to a particular person who started your book, Silas James. I mean, you talk about how stark the contrast was between the Urbana you grew up in compared to the one that Silas grew up in. Can you talk about how your paths seem so similar in some ways, but they were so divergent?
Yeah. So I did a lot of reporting just to find a, quote, young me for the book and talk to teachers and counselors. And I said, I want a promising poor kid. They all pointed to him. You know, he had grown up in a family with addiction. His father had died of a drug overdose. His mother was in and out of prison. And he didn't have one stable parent. Mm-hmm. And so what I saw in Silas's story was just a whole nother level of trauma and abuse. He had been abused by a caregiver at a young age. And that all sort of dovetails once I did the research and I saw that, you know, foster care had tripled since 2015 in Urbana. The number of emergency calls for mental health crises had gone up by a factor of 9 in the 40 years since I had left. And yet, Silas, kind of like me, managed to grab onto these teachers who were real beacons in his life that sort of made a way for him.
And another divergence between you and Silas, you got a Pell Grant to attend college. And now kids like Silas, they don't have that same chance because the purchasing power of the Pell Grant has radically declined, right? How
That's
do you see
right.
that affecting the educational opportunities of poor Americans now?
Oh, it's so huge. I mean, basically, we have taken a four-year college degree away from poor kids or even lower middle class kids. And we've said either go to the community college or take out loans, which is really dire for even middle class families, right?
Yeah.
So when I went, the whole thing was paid for, even my books, room and board, tuition. I got work study jobs so I could buy pizza and beer just like everybody else. Mm-hmm. And when Silas went, he had all of his tuition covered, but because he went to a community college, there was no money for him to like move out of his house and live nearby the college. And the college was an hour away, which meant he had to have reliable transportation. And I watched that poor kid, he dropped out the first week because his car died. And then once he got re-enrolled, I watched him go through 5 clunker cars in the course of a 10-month program.
God, I can't imagine. Well, when you were young, you had a paper route, hence the title of this book, Paper Girl. And you've since had a decorated career as a journalist, and a lot of your book deals with the spread of misinformation and growing contempt for journalists. Can I ask you, like, because I think about this question, what does it feel like to be a member of a profession that many people in your own hometown, many people in the country, probably distrust?
It feels painful. My first friend, I've known her since kindergarten. She conducted my mom's funeral. This is how much I love her. She's the one who gave me a ride to school every day.
Wow.
She said, I hate the media. All of this is the media's fault. And I said, Joy, I am the media. And when I write a piece for the New York Times or the Washington Post, it is fact-checked to the nth degree. Mm-hmm. And at one point, she raised her voice to me and she said, who fact-checks the fact-checkers? And I said, Joy, facts are facts. Like, you know, I was just astonished to hear that. And she just, like my sister Cookie, the one who said the election was fraudulent, mm-hmm. she lives in an entirely different news ecosystem than I believe in. And it felt personal when people were saying, you know,
absolutely.
You lie.
Well, then let me ask you a question that a lot of us here at NPR are asking. How do we get people to care more about fact-based journalism? How do we persuade the people we're losing to come back and seek truthful information?
Well, I think we need to pay more attention to what's happening in these rural areas, right? More mm-hmm. stories mm-hmm. about them. We need to start to build back legacy media institutions. I mean, where I live in Roanoke, Virginia, when I first came to work at the paper in 1989, we had 60-some reporters. Now they have 6.
Oh my God.
So think about all the things that aren't being covered.
Yeah.
At the same time, you've got these like really hardworking, sort of demoralized final few reporters, and then people attack them.
Right.
It's just terrible. But I think we have to keep telling the stories. And one of the things I came away with from the book is we have to start with our families. As hard as it is to have these conversations, you know, that is maybe the people we'll have the best chance with talking across the divide.
Beth Macy's new book is called Paper Girl, a memoir of home and family in fractured America. Thank you so much, Beth. It was such a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Elsa.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from BetterHelp, committed to helping clients with issues ranging from relationship challenges and goal setting to grief and depression. Learn more at betterhelp.com/public. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in Northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. We receive support from Bemidji Brewing, announcing the return of their espresso porter filled with roasted coffee flavor. Now on tap and in cans throughout the region. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. Native Defense presents the second annual Our Voices Restored community event Saturday, October 11th from 11 to 3 at the Beaux Arts Ballroom on the campus of Bemidji State University. There will be panel discussions, local music, a community meal, and resource table. Free and open to all. Weather tonight, mostly clear skies, lows in the upper 30s, areas of frost on the eastern Iron Range. Tomorrow, sunny, highs in the mid-50s, widespread frost overnight, and Wednesday,